The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from NationalGeographic.com and National Geographic Traveler Magazine. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you, neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Have you ever traveled along a highway and felt like you were in the middle of nowhere? Like you were the only one, and should something happen, you might be stranded for who knows how long before help arrived. On today's Armchair Traveler, we explore This is the Loneliest Road in America, a title that was made by Life magazine several decades ago and written by Hannah Lott Swartz for NationalGeographic.com in the last couple of weeks. And as the editors note, a Gold Rush-era highway paves the way to the West's last frontier. There are photographs accompanying this, and they are and a video, and these were done by a gentleman named Matthias Vold. We'll have more on him a little later in the program. Here we go with the article by Hannah Lott Swartz. Where the state of Nevada folds in half from the elbow on its western arm at Lake Tahoe across to its Utah border, you'll find the most direct route across the state. It crosses several communities, a handful of mountain ranges, a national park, and one reservoir, where bobcats, foxes, and wild horses roam free. There's life, yes, but not a familiar way of life for many. It's a place where the lines between John Wayne Westerns and everyday life blur, where ghost towns bleed into living ones. This is Route 50, the loneliest road in America. Or so says Life magazine. In July 1986, the publication honored the Statue of Liberty's 100th birthday and highlighted American superlatives. On one page, the cutest, a toddler actor, appears alongside the loneliest road below a photo of a seemingly endless highway that reaches across the desert toward the mountains, a lone cowboy on horseback crossing from one side of nothingness to the other. An anonymous AAA counselor is quoted in the article, "We warn all motorists not to drive there unless they're confident of their survival skills." Rather than keep motorists away, however, the moniker piqued curiosity thanks in part to the Nevada Commission on Tourism. The public relations director at the time saw an opportunity in the article and released a Highway 50 survival guide the same month the Life article came out, rewarding visitors to the area with a certificate of survival signed by the governor. Highway signs touting the qualifier went up along the route at the same time, and it graduated from opinion to slogan. Before it was known as the loneliest road in America, Route 50 was anything but. In the 1850s, the Gold Rush sparked a caravan of wagons to head west along the thruway. According to the Highway 50 Association, the Roaring Road, as it was called, became so congested at times that hopeful miners and their families would have to wait days before they could access it, a Panama Canal of sorts standing between the new frontier and the old. By the turn of the century, the road became California's first state highway and eventually connected the nation's Atlantic and Pacific coast. To this day, the California Department of Transportation calls Route 50 the backbone of America. And yet, as photographer Matthias Vold sat in his car along a network of dirt roads surrounded by miles and miles of yellow and red desert grass and the rattlesnakes he had just narrowly avoided stepping on, it didn't feel like that. "I was overwhelmed," the Copenhagen-based photographer recalls, "on one side with the beautiful nature, but also the snake reminded me that this is a dangerous environment. It was just me alone in the desert with a snake," he says. That sort of isolation follows Route 50 for almost the entirety of its 400 miles across Nevada, but it's particularly pronounced along this stretch. The 287 miles between Ely and Friendly, designated by Life as the loneliest road. Here, you can't count on cell service or gas stations, on places to eat or even people to wave as you pass, anything to replace the eeriness of the hungry red desert around you. Even its small towns seemingly materialize and then fade into the desert. existence like a mirage. Meet the man who has lived alone on an island for 28 years. Ooh. From an economic development standpoint, we're not considered rural, says Dee Helming, chairwoman of the Pony Express Territory, which works with the State Tourism Authority to promote the towns along Route 50. We're considered frontier, she says. That's precisely the draw for some of its residents. There's just a mystique about Nevada, says Helming. She moved to Austin, one of the few towns along the highway, in 1981, and today owns a laundromat, a bed and breakfast, and a cafe with her husband, Kip. For us, it's that freedom of living old school, I guess. It's a whole different way of life. Your community is more dependent on each other. You have to understand you're 112 miles from the nearest Walmart. You're 110 miles from the nearest stoplight. You learn a lot of independence, she notes. She encourages her B&B guests to discover the outdoors, get intimate with history, and wander the ghost towns to experience the very life that she and others along the highway live every day. They either love it or they're so intimidated that they'll never come back, she says. She arrived a tourist. The island inspired her to become its sole nun. Bobby McShane, head of maintenance, has worked at Big Four for the better part of two decades. After welcoming Sebold inside and grabbing a beer, he pointed out paintings of a woman that hung all around the barroom. According to McShane, a customer fell in love with one of the women working at the brothel, the same woman who looked down at them from her many frames. He spent all his money on her. He painted these really beautiful paintings of her to pay the debt, Sebold says. In Denmark, brothels are not illegal, but they are taboo. But Bobby was romanticizing the stories from there, telling them like love stories. Perhaps, thought Sebold, the loneliest road in America isn't so lonely after all. It's big and vast and seemingly endless, and in that there's solitude. Yes, but not sadness. And anybody can go there and look around and say, wow, this is lonely, and then leave and go back where they came from, says Sebold. But people who live there, it's a permanent mindset. The difference is having the solitude inside you instead of being a temporary feeling. Well, our writer, Hannah Lott Swartz, is a journalist, and she is based in San Diego, California. And by the way, you can catch more of her articles and information about her at Twitter. It's a seahorse. That's ITSASEA horse. It's a seahorse is her moniker, I guess you would call it, on Twitter. Matthias Sebold, of course, is a documentary photographer, and he's based in Denmark, and he can be followed on Instagram at Matthias Bold. That's MATHIASSVOLD, Matthias Sebold. And, you know, we've talked about his photographs and the fact that he made a video for the article that is online at National Geographic. He's provided several photographs for the article we're reading, and I want to share some of the captions that's going to give you an idea of some of the content and what he's found along Route 50 in this loneliest road in America, okay? First photograph, we find this fellow named John lives in his car, topped with a sign that reads, "Pray for me, please." Now, he stayed on Route 50 for 3 weeks and says the sign is a way to start conversations with people who pass by. Second photograph, Spencer's Hot Springs, located near the town of Austin on Route 50. 71-year-old Jerry Britt first visited the spring 40 years ago, and he has consistently returned because he enjoys the isolation. Know anybody like that? And then number three is Lonnie, plays pool at Jerry Lee's Honky Tonk. That's a dive bar in Silver Spring along Route 50. Number four is a group of horses from an open ranch, and they walk through the small town of Silver Springs, Nevada. And number five is Middlegate Station. It's on Route 50 and overlooks the seemingly endless desert. And there are photos of lonely, isolated stops, and this is just one example of them. Now, number six is a ranch in Dixie Valley, Nevada, and where they brand their cattle. Cattle ranches are the main industry along U.S. Route 50, and cowboys work from morning to dark. So if you want to see cowboys, that's probably one way to do it. And number seven is cowboy Clay Sternler. He travels from ranch to ranch for work along Route 50. And then we have the Desirest Motel. It sits on the roadside in Ely, Nevada. And Desirest, I guess, is perhaps the better way to pronounce that. D-E-S-E-R-E-S-T. Desirest Motel. And then number nine is a lone soda machine sitting at a gas station in Baker, Nevada, near the Utah border. Better grab one before you keep going, because I suspect it'll be a while before you find another. Number 10, a portrait of a horse hangs in the Pony Canyon Motel in Austin, Nevada. Now, Major's place on Route 50 is a dusty old roadhouse and RV park, and the fence surrounding Major's place is decorated with antlers. And then we have, in photograph 12, an off-highway vehicle rolls down Sand Mountain, a two-mile sand dune outside Fallon, Nevada. Now, number 13 is about a fellow named Michael Kerrigan. He was born and raised in Ely, Nevada, and on most days he sits outside his neighbor's house to connect to their Wi-Fi. He says, "It's very true that this is a lonely place. I hate this town and its rude people. If I could, I would move to Hawaii." Number 14, construction workers, lots of them, completing road work on Route 50 in Ely, Nevada. And then we have, in the next photograph, Anthony Livriani and Jacob Sanford. Now, these guys are just 12 years old, and they live in Ely. And they are on their way to rent a DVD for a movie night and like playing with their friends and dogs. That must be an exciting time along Route 50, huh? And while speaking of Route 50, there's Hotel Nevada, and this is a six-story casino and hotel from 1929. It's also located in Ely, Nevada, the tallest building in the state until 1931. And finally, we have the Border Inn. This is a gas station, motel, and diner on the Utah-Nevada border in Baker, Nevada. And the next gas station, 83 miles east, so you better fill up now. Wow. Talking about the loneliest highway, huh? Well, from the loneliest road in America, we're going to head to the Northwest for a wild ride. Cowboys and cowgirls wrangled the Old West at Wyoming's Classic Rodeo. Our writer and guide's Jonathan Smith. His article is from the June-July 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. He begins, "My 8-year-old daughter flew off the back of the mechanical bull and landed in a heap of curly hair and denim. Grinning, Ivy picked herself up off the padded surface and set her black cowboy hat back in place. She begged for just one more go. Please? But the sun was setting over Cody, Wyoming, and it was almost time for the night rodeo to start. Here, outside the area on the edge of town, or outside the arena on the edge of town, the rodeo clowns had finished painting kids' faces, and the cowboys were coiling their ropes, lasso lessons over. Everyone was heading toward the stands to find a seat. Tomorrow, sweetie," I said, steering her into the crowd. Cody has been holding an annual July 4th rodeo called the Stampede since 1919, and a nightly rodeo most summer evenings since 1938, making the Cody Night Rodeo the longest-running event of its kind. The town's location, 52 miles east of Yellowstone National Park, helps ensure a steady stream of tourists, but the rodeo is a community event as well. It's geared to families and first-timers or folks who were both like us. We found a spot in the front row of the elevated grandstand. People called out to friends in the stands and in the contestants' area below. We could hear snippets of French and Japanese and smell farm dirt and fried food. The announcer's opening prayer centered on safety for the contestants, spectators driving home, the troops at home and abroad. A young woman carrying an American flag rode around the field as everyone stood to sing the national anthem. I nudged Ivy to take her hat off. I had to keep reminding myself that every single part of this summer experience was new to her. We had arrived the day before from a home in Portland, Oregon, an abrupt cultural transition, to say the least. This year had been full of changes. We had moved in the spring, and Ivy was set to start third grade soon at a new school. Our visit to Cody would be her first real exposure to this red-blooded streak of American culture, and our first daddy-daughter overnight trip. I wanted everything to be perfect, as long as she didn't come home begging for a horse. The Cowgirl Up Rodeo Drill Team rode out and galloped in complex formations as the announcer read off the names of local sponsors. Ivy's eyes were bright, and she clutched my arm in excitement. It was time for the first event, bareback bronc riding. 30 feet below us, a knot of cowboys surrounded a horse and rider in a gated chute. They held the animal still as the young rider grabbed the leather and rawhide rigging handhold with his left hand and took a deep breath. There was a moment of stillness. The rider nodded. The gate flew open. The pair exploded outward in a blur of kicking, plunging, and spinning. The three-dimensional thrashing flung the man almost horizontal along the horse's back. Within seconds, he was airborne and in the dirt. "That's the horse's job. Get that cowboy off its back," the announcer said, as the contestant limped back to the fence and the crowd cheered the effort. A ride has to last 8 seconds to earn a score from the judges, which is based on equally on performance of man and horse. The rider must have one arm free at all times, and it must not touch any part of the animal or the equipment. Doing so means disqualification. Tonight, only a few rides lasted the full 8. I cringed as each successive contestant hit the ground, but Ivy was transfixed. 2 pickup men on horseback waited nearby to make sure things ended safely for everyone if the rider managed to stay on. 1 pulled him to safety on his own horse, and the other ushered the barebacked animal out of the arena. Gary Hayes, a member of the rodeo board, joined us just as the saddle bronc riding started. He pointed out how every horse bucked differently, some straight up and down, some spinning, fast and slow, high and low. They were bred to love the competition, he said, and nurtured as carefully as any top athlete. They work an hour a year, 8 seconds at a time, he said. Not a bad life. He explained how rodeo events had their roots in real ranching activities like rounding up cows, catching new calves for branding, and convincing young horses to accept a rider for the first time. The word rodeo comes from the Spanish word rodear, which means to surround. Cowboys always competed informally in their spare time, but the idea of turning practical skills into spectator events came toward the end of the 19th century. Railroads and barbed wire fences had brought the era of cattle drives and the open range to an end. The romantic mystique of the American West was gaining ground, and rodeos would cement it as part of our national identity. Nobody was more responsible for this than William F. Buffalo Bill Cody, the hunter, scout, and showman, whose Wild West show toured the U.S. and Europe and performed for presidents, kings, and Queen Victoria. At his peak, near the turn of the century, Cody was likely one of the most famous people on earth. In the 1890s, Cody helped found the town that bears his name along the Shoshone River. His showman eyes could see its potential for ranching, hunting, fishing, and tourism. The wonders of Yellowstone, founded as a national park in 1872, were already drawing visitors, as were dude ranches, where tenderfoots from the east could vacation and play cowboy. The Irma Hotel downtown, opened in 1902 and still going strong, was named after Cody's daughter. My own daughter apparently wasn't fazed a bit at seeing grown men tossed around like a crash test dummy. Granted, Ivy has an indoor trapeze and once managed to overturn trampoline in her dining room, but I wondered what she would think about the next event. A calf bolted from a gate, followed seconds later by a galloping rider swinging a lasso in wide circles. A quick toss settled the loop around the animal's neck, and the horse stopped on a dime. The rope pulled taut, jerked the calf off its feet. The cowboy sprang down with short picking string in his teeth. He quickly looped it around 3 of the calf's feet and leapt back, hands in the air. The time counted only if the knot held for 6 seconds. After a few early winces, we saw how the lassos missed more often than not, and how the calves, who were caught always, scrambled up and trotted off, indignant but unhurt. They looked small from here, but the calves probably weighed more than Ivy and me put together. And by the end, we were cheering as much for the animals zigzagging across the dirt as the riders trying to catch them. In between events, a rodeo clown kept the crowd entertained with corny jokes and banter. So, a 3-legged dog walks into a saloon and says, "I'm looking for the man who shot my paw." At the halfway point of the evening, he called all the kids in the crowd down from the stands. Ivy rushed to join them. Everyone lined up at one end of the field, and a pair of calves with red flags tied to their tails were let loose at the other end. Anyone who grabbed a flag won a gift certificate to the local Dairy Queen. It was madness. Children howling, dirt clods flying, calves trotting bemusedly along the fence line. I saw at least one six-year-old get flattened in the scrum and came up running. Two local kids, clearly benefiting from experience, ended up with the prizes. Ivy limped back to her seat, grimy but glowing. I don't think I should have worn my new boots, she said sheepishly. I bought her some kettle corn as a consolation prize. Everything was so darn wholesome, a welcome respite from the cynicism and daily disasters that seemed to dominate the news. We wanted to be family-focused from the start, says Nikki Tate, who started running the rodeo with her husband, Mari, a former pro rodeo cowboy, in 2005. We had two little girls, and we knew that if kids have a good time, parents definitely do. For 80% of our guests, this is their first rodeo. The rodeo can be an arena for other firsts as well. Women have been competing in rodeo since the dawn of the 20th century. While the official first competitor is hotly debated, cowgirls such as Lucille Mulhall, Bertha Kaepernick, and also known as Bertha Kaepernick Blanchett, and Prairie Rose Henderson became as famous as any man. Mulhall, for example, performed at Madison Square Garden and lassoed and tied three steers in 3 minutes, 36 seconds. She earned many titles, including Champion Lady Steer Roper of the World. But even she faced casual sexism. The New York World wrote how Mulhall could break a bronc, lasso and brand a deer, and shoot a coyote at 500 yards, and also play Chopin, quote, Browning, and make mayonnaise. In Cody, Nikki Tate says women and men can compete in the same events, but most women only team rope a barrel race. Men are not allowed to compete in the latter. Barrel racing turned out to be Ivy's favorite event. Every rider pushed her horse to the limits, and they galloped in a cloverleaf pattern around three barrels. Knocking over one meant a five-second penalty. Each age group of barrel riders was younger than the one before, and Ivy was entranced by the accomplished riding skill of girls her age and younger. The last few peewee riders were no more than 3 or 4 years old, trotting around the course on patient ponies. It was getting late, and even the bull riders in their helmets and protective vests didn't excite Ivy as much as the pre-team barrel racers. I had wondered if one night at the rodeo would be enough, but as we walked back to the hotel under the stars, Ivy asked, "Can we come back?" Getting Ivy out of bed the next morning took a little extra encouragement. But by 7:45 a.m., we were driving west following the North Fork of the Shoshone River upstream toward Yellowstone. Our target was the Absaroka Mountain Lodge, a cluster of tidy log cabins tucked amid pine-forested hills, 12 miles outside the park boundary. At the check-in desk was a photo of two grizzly bears nosing around the outside of the cabins. "They like to flip over rocks and stumps to look for grubs," said owner Carrie Boyd, handing over waivers to sign. For the Good Morning Sunshine Trail Ride, two college-age cowgirls matched us and another family of five with horses, each more docile than the last. They led us single file up a trail through a wide valley dotted with blackened snags from a 2008 fire. The slow rocking and warming sun were mildly hypnotic. I knew Ivy wanted to gallop since she had asked if we could at least three times a day for the past week. Considering this was her second time on a horse, though, I figured we'd follow the guide's lead. Wrangler Katie Allspaw watched Ivy ease into the rhythm of the saddle. "She's a natural," she said. "You're going to have to get her a horse." I prayed Ivy didn't hear the second part. At one stream crossing, a bush swept Ivy's new hat off her head. It was part of a cowgirl outfit we had picked up in Cody the day before, complete with boots, shirt, and horseshoe earrings. A horse stepped on it before we could pick it up. Ivy was thrilled. Real trail mud. Toward the end of the ride, the bushes on the hillside 20 yards away rustled, and a grizzly bear stood up, eyeing us curiously. From its size and coloring, it looked about 2 years old, probably one of the stump flippers. I thought the horses were a little skittish, Allspaw said calmly, giving the order to turn around. Back in town, Ivy and I spent the afternoon browsing Western-themed gift shops in Cody's historic downtown and, of course, swimming in the hotel pool. As my daughter did her fifth cannonball, I thought back to trips I had taken with my parents across the West when I was her age. I wondered what part of this she'd remember best 10 or 20 years from now. Would it be the free cookies every afternoon in the lobby? Every parent knows sugar's memory-enhancing powers. Our laughs over the misspelled hotel sign, Dog Friendy, F-R-I-E-N-D-Y, which they fixed after we told them at the front desk. I'd remember the look on her face when she had been picked to ring the dinner bell and yell, "Come and get it," at the Cody Cattle Company's trail-style buffet. I'd also remember the great live country music during the meal. I knew I wouldn't forget how she sprang up the stairs during our second visit to the rodeo, eager to get another good seat, or how the elderly couple next to us, grandparents of one of the junior steer riders, loaned us a blanket when they saw Ivy starting to shiver. It was already beginning to feel familiar, with the rodeo clown making the same jokes as yesterday and my daughter evaluating steer ropers like an old hand. Is he going to make it? Is he going to make it? 15 seconds. That's third place. A trio of preteen girls sitting in front of us kept taking selfies and giggling when the boys sent photos in response. I knew that would be Ivy soon enough, posting on Snapchat or Flirt Swap or whatever the hot app will be in 2023. But not yet. And as my daughter cheered another barrel rider, I hugged her even closer. What a great article, huh? Well, whether you travel lonely highways or take in classic events like rodeos, you can always find some unique destination. Just ask writer Heather Greenwood Davis. Now, in her June-July 2018 National Geographic Traveler's article, Epic Summer, she gives us getaways packed with unforgettable adventures from amusement parks to zip lining, and we're going to read part of these today in this episode. She begins with Back to Basics, and one starts in Ohio, Glazed and Sprinkled. You're going to love this one. Dunk into Ohio's first and only donut trail, which samples a dozen family-owned bakeries in Butler County. Doughy fried treats come in flavors ranging from raspberry cheesecakes to fruity pebbles. Get a stamp at each stop along the trail and earn a free T-shirt at the end. And by the way, you can go online to learn more. Get to the BC. GetToTheBC.com/donut, D-O-N-U-T, hyphen trail. That's GetToTheBC.com/donut-trail. Next, we head to South Carolina for a slowdown at Dafuski. With more than 5,000 tranquil acres accessible only by boat, Dafuski Island feels like a throwback to prehistoric, okay, maybe pre-Xbox days. Here on South Carolina's southernmost inhabited sea island, you can stroll white sand beaches, learn about the island's gullah heritage, ride horses along the trails, or explore on bicycles. But don't come inside till the streetlights are on. And you can tour Dafuski.com to get more information online. That's Tour Dafuski, DAUFUSKIE.com. Then we have the classic camp up in Vermont. You're never too old for summer camp at the all-inclusive Tyler Place Family Resort near Vermont's border with Quebec. Adults enjoy yoga classes and pottery workshops while counselors lead kids on fishing trips and rounds of Capture the Flag. TylerPlace.com is where you find more information about this classic camp. That's TylerPlace.com. Now we head to another topic area, this one animal lovers, and we began in Alaska with Northern Encounters. Spotting grizzly bears, wolves, caribou, and humpback whales is great. Having a naturalist on hand to answer any questions is even better. Meet these experts on Nat Geo's Family Expedition in Alaska, which explores Denali National Park, drives Seward Highway, and cruises Kenai Fjords. Now, this is all found online at natgeoexpeditions.com/explore. natgeoexpeditions.com/explore. Next, we head to British Columbia for whale tales. Wild Coast Adventures Orca Camp is a 4 or 5 day adventure that gets you out kayaking among pods of orcas in British Columbia's Johnstone Strait. At night, glamp in safari-style tents or northeastern Vancouver Island. And this has a website, too, kayakbritishcolumbia.com, kayakbritishcolumbia.com. And our next stop is Dino's Rule in Illinois. And Sue, the 40-and-a-half-foot-long T-Rex that has presided over Chicago's Field Museum since 2000, is heading for some needed updates, and they've replaced it with a 122-foot-long titanosaur, the biggest dinosaur ever discovered. And we'll tell you more about that one in a future episode, because we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, the program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at the website trianglereadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.